Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. As I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
Thank you.
If people say your dreams are crazy, if they laugh at what you think you can do, good. Stay that way. Because what non-believers fail to understand is that calling a dream crazy is not an insult. It's a compliment. Don't try to be the fastest runner in your school or the fastest in the world. Be the fastest ever. Don't picture yourself wearing OBJ's jersey. Picture OBJ wearing yours. Don't settle for homecoming queen or linebacker. Do both. Lose 120 pounds and become an Ironman after beating a brain tumor. Don't believe you have to be like anybody to be somebody. If you're born a refugee, don't let it stop you from playing soccer for the national team at age 16. Don't become the best basketball player on the planet. Be bigger than basketball. Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything. When they talk about the greatest team in the history of the sport, make sure it's your team. If you have only one hand, don't just watch football. Play it at the highest level. And if you're a girl from Compton, don't just become a tennis player. Become the greatest athlete ever. Yeah, that's more like it. So don't ask if your dreams are crazy. Ask if they're crazy enough.
Today's It's My House is titled, because we had to come up. I started this podcast like 4 minutes after I was supposed to start it. So it was in the conversation. Let's see if I can get the guy on. Well, let me give you the name of the podcast. It's Solving Problems by Making Widgets. Solving Problems by Making Widgets. Live stream number 619-768-2945. I want to dovetail at the top into what I was talking to a friend of mine about right before, like I said, I was 4 minutes late starting this podcast. We have a debate going between us that I believe that anybody can get good at anything. They had two things. They have to learn to do, well, three things. They have to have a desire, number one. Number two, they have to learn the fundamentals. And number three, they have to put in the time where they can get good. And he doesn't believe it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this musical interlude and see if I can get him in the studio today. All right.
Yo, let's do this.
Nightmare walking, psychopath talking, king of my jungle, just a gangster stalking, living life like a firecracker, quick as my fuse, vendettas of death, that's the colors I choose, red or blue, cuz of blood, it just don't matter, sucker died for your life when my shotgun scattered, cuz the gangs of L.A. will never die, just multiply colors, cuz, you don't know me, fool. You disown me? Cool. I don't need your assistance. Social persistence. Any problem I got, I just put my fist in. My life is violent, but violence is life. Peace is a dream, reality is a night. My colors, my honor, my colors, my all. With my colors upon me, one soldier stands tall. Tell me, what have you left me? What have I got? Last night in cold blood, my young brother got shot. My homeboy got jacked, my mother's on crack. My
sister can't work cause her arm show trapped. Madness, insanity, living profanity. Then some punk claiming they're understanding me. Give me a break, what world do you live in? Death is my set, guess my religion.
Color, 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 color. My pants are sagging, braided hair. Suckers there, but I don't care. My game ain't knowledge, my game fear. I've no remorse, so squares beware. But my two missions is just revenge. You ain't my set, you ain't my friend. Wear the wrong color, your life could end. Homicide's my favorite binge color.
Color, 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 color.
So I'll just walk like a giant, police defiant. You'll say to stop, but I'll say that I can't. My gang, my family, it's all that I have. I'm a star on the wall, my autograph. You don't like it, so you know where you can go. Suck the streets on my stage and tear at my show. Psychoanalyze, try diagnose me. Why? It wasn't your brother to brutally die, but it was mine, so let me define. My territory, don't cross the line. Don't try to act crazy, cause that shit don't faze me. If you ran like a punk, it wouldn't amaze me, cause my color's death. Though we all want peace, but our war won't end till all wars cease.
Color, 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 color.
Okay, today's podcast, once again, is titled Solving Problems by Making Widgets, W-I-D-G-S, Solving Problems by Making Widgets. And we want to tie that into, like I said, I was having a discussion with a friend of mine. I sent him a message that hopefully he can call in because I want to continue it on air, but you guys can chime in. I believe this goes into solving problems by making widgets. I believe that anybody that's of normal, well, what's normal? I believe that anybody of, let's say, normal physical capabilities, they don't have any, for the most part, they don't even have any physical handicaps. But even some with physical handicaps. But I believe that people in general can become good at anything they desire to be. Let's say a person does not know anything about cooking. They don't know how to cook. Can't boil water without burning up the pot or pan or whatever. I believe that person, if they have the desire to learn how to become a cook. As a matter of fact, I'm going to even go a step further. Become a world-class chef. I believe if they have the desire, that's the number one thing. Number two, learn the fundamentals. And number three, put in the time practicing those fundamentals, that person could become a world-class chef And I'll throw that into the, I believe that F students can become honor roll students if they learn the fundamentals of becoming a, you know, a good student and put in the time and effort of the fundamentals of becoming a good student at a subject or a series of subjects, they can become honor roll students. I believe that across the board. So that's what we were, I think, started was centered around sports. But I'm going to play a clip here that I played maybe a week ago or 2 weeks ago called The First 20 Hours. Because I know for myself, there are a few things that, you know, that I wanted to achieve. And essentially, I learned the fundamentals and put in the work to get in the position that I wanted to get in. Now, before I go to that, matter of fact, something we're working on right now, okay? I am not a carpenter. Not a carpenter. Really don't desire to become a carpenter, or particularly a master carpenter. But I've got to learn some fundamentals of carpentry. Now, this goes to our title today, Solving Problems by Making Widgets. The widget that I'm interested in producing, and that's the operative word, producing, are tiny houses. Or out and or outdoor buildings. Okay, tiny, what people call tiny houses, and I'm just saying it because, well, anyway, I'm not going to get into the technicalities of it. But so widget, but I'm not a carpenter. Now I've helped build tiny houses, but I'm not the one that can explain step by step. My goal is to produce a certain amount on a daily basis to solve some problems that my mother has and avoid some or extinguish some that if I won't even come get in that position. All right, so now, but I'm not a carpenter. Now, I'm going to play a clip here called The First 20 Hours. Now, what I've done, I'm probably an hour, 5 or 6. The First 20 Hours, the book that we were talking about here about 2-3 weeks ago, The First 20 Hours says that you can take any topic that you know nothing about but you have some type of interest in and learn the fundamentals of that in the first 20 hours. It could be walking, it could be talking, how we learn how to walk, how we learn how to talk, arithmetic, cooking, auto mechanic, whatever it is. But the first 20 hours, quality 20 hours, you're learning the fundamentals. All right, so now with me, I'm going to put it at 6 hours. I got 6 hours out of the first 20 hours in. That includes, now yesterday, Sunday, I went to Lowe's and picked out, well, let me put it this way. All right, the widget that I'm interested in learning how to do, okay, because I'm not a carpenter, is how to put together a tiny house, build a tiny house by myself. All right, Now, my motivation in doing that is so I can teach somebody who has zero skill level and teach them all, this is the way I want it done, with the goal of so we can produce 2, 3, 4, 5 a day or whatever that figure might be. And And part of my first 6 hours so far, I've talked to master carpenters and some woodworkers, because there's a distinction between the two of them, where some of them said, well, you know what, this particular project, you know, in order to build this structure, it'll take 3 weeks. I talked to one person like that. I talked to several that can do it in 3 days or a week. And I talked to a handful that can do it in a day. So the people that I'm giving more energy to now is the ones who can actually from scratch build these tiny structures, or what we call tiny structures, in a day. Now, essentially in a day, if they're going solo, all right, they can, from scratch, they can put together the shell of the building, all right? And that's good enough for me, from zero to putting up the shell of the building, because the shell of the building will allow me to move it commercially the way I want to move it. All right. One guy I talked to, he started off by himself, and I asked him, because he probably produces probably 10 a day now. But he started off, he didn't know anything about building outdoor buildings. But his sister had an outdoor building by a pretty big name branding producer. So what he did was he took a look at that building and copied it, you know, on what that model was. And it took him a week and a half, let's say 10 days, a week, what, 2 weeks is 14 days. So it took him a week and a half, let's say 10 days, nine, 10 days. Let's put it at 10 days. It took him 10 days to build his first building. And he said essentially he didn't enroll in any school, didn't go to any community college. It was trial and error. But he built that first one and then put it on the edge of the property with a sign for sale and a phone number in his name, and that's how he got into the business of selling outdoor buildings. All right. And trial and error, and he went from a week and a half from production solo building to, you know, on a regular build, regardless of weather, build one building a day solo. Soon, he found somebody, once again, that did not know how to build anything. He taught them how to build, and then when they got good at building, he hired them a helper. And then he stepped completely out of the technical side of building the outdoor buildings into the exclusively sales part of the building, because before he was building and selling. All right. And then he just kept on that process until he had several crews producing several buildings a day. So right now that's the type of mentor I'm dealing with. Okay. So anyway, but the point I'm making is he didn't know anything about carpentry or simple construction when he started. All right. Which takes us to, well, let me find it here. The first, all right, I'm trying to find it for you guys. I'm trying to find an audio on the first 20 hours. But anyway, that's my belief. I believe that anybody can get good at anything if they have the desire, learn the fundamentals, and then put in the work to improve on that particular skill set. And by doing that, you can solve many problems that you might have or somebody else might have in the process. So 619-768-2945. I don't believe there's the concept of the natural, well, there might be, I can't find this. Hold on, what you guys here. Once again, I believe a person can be a total, let me play this one. I'm trying to play the other one. I mean, find another one. Anyway, 619-768-2945. What are your comments on can anybody learn anything provided they have the skill set?
Back in the year 1843, a man was born who, during his lifetime, was to have a profound effect on literally millions of people. His name was Russell Herman Conwell. He became a lawyer, then a newspaper editor, and finally a clergyman in 1881. It was during this latter period that an incident occurred which was to change his life and the lives of countless others. One day a group of boys came to Dr. Conwell at his church and asked him if he would be willing to instruct them in college courses. They wanted a college education but lacked the money to attend. He told them he'd do all he could, and as the boys left, a thought, an idea began forming in Dr. Conwell's mind.
Malcolm Gladwell is here. He is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. His first two books, The Tipping Point and Blink, each sold well over 2 million copies in the United States. His unique take on the world ultimately has even spawned its own term, Gladwellian. His new book is called Outliers, The Story of Success. I am very pleased to have him back at this table. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Now tell me, I said to you as you sat down, I am fascinated by performance and success. And success in terms of the essence of it. And how do you get there? Not that there's a magic formula, but what can we understand about it?
No, it is, it's this sort of perennially interesting question. And there are so many different answers depending on who you ask and when you ask them. And that's why we keep returning to it. If it was some little simple algorithm we could apply, it wouldn't capture our imagination in the same way.
It is said that part of the reason for this book, and there is some personal biography here, you talk about your grandmother, was that you were in search of explaining your own success, this phenomenal success you've had.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was a conscious attempt. I would never do something so explicitly autobiographically, consciously. But I suppose on some level, that question began to occur to me because my own success doesn't seem to me to be entirely rational, or it certainly wasn't anything I would have expected.
And you couldn't necessarily look at particular biographical points and say, aha, this guy is going to be either president or write bestsellers.
Yeah, it seemed that I got really lucky. I mean, luck is a huge theme in this book. And it's funny, we're not very good with luck. We tend to sort of discount it. We'd always rather give a kind of considered explanation for something than just to say it's happenstance. But you know what? A lot of the time, it really is. And in the book, I try and sort of zero in on what is exactly the nature of the lucky break that characterizes so much of truly outstanding success.
Okay, let's take an easy example that you use. Mm-hmm. Bill Gates.
Yeah, so Bill Gates is lucky in many ways.
Yeah, very bright.
He starts two ways in particular. One is that when he walks into eighth grade at Lakeside Academy in Seattle in 1968, there is a computer terminal sitting there with a link into a mainframe in downtown Seattle. No one had access to a computer terminal in eighth grade or ninth grade or tenth grade or even college in 1968.
Anywhere else in the world.
No, and he himself told me, he's like, if there were 50 people in my position in 1968, I'd be stunned. And he basically spends his entire teenage years programming, right? Because of this gift. And he would tell me one point, Paul Allen, his great high school buddy, with whom he co-founds Microsoft, discovers there's a mainframe down at University of Washington that's free, it's not being used, between 2 and 6 in the morning. So he goes to bed at 10 o'clock, sets the alarm clock, climbs out the window, whatever, at 1:30 in the morning, walks 2 miles to the University of Washington, and programs from 2 till 6. Now, I love that story because it's the two parts of his success are right there. One is the extraordinary desire and obsessiveness and determination and love of computing, but the other is the fact that he's a guy who lives 2 miles from a mainframe in 1973 that's free between 2 and 6 in the morning, right? Now, lots of people may have the first thing. Almost no one has the second thing, right? I could have walked for a month and not come on to a mainframe.
Right, but this is central to what you're saying here, and so let's explore it in more. The Beatles.
Yeah. Same thing. So Beatles, I'm really interested in one of the other themes I come back to in the book is this notion of how long does it take to be good at something?
Exactly.
And psychologists who have looked at this in the expertise literature have said, you know what, if you look at a whole range of cognitively complex activities, time and time again we see that expertise is reached only after a minimum of 10,000 hours of practice. And that roughly translates to 10 years of doing something. And I do this actually now with anyone who's good at something. I could do it with you right now. I just ask people, all right, in your career, what was the point that you started to feel comfortable in your role? And it's always 10 years. It's always 10 years. And I'm sure if we did the math with you right now, it would come out to...
No, you're right, you're right, you're right.
And yeah. so this magic number of 10,000 hours, what that says is the first in a cohort to reach 10,000 hours has a huge advantage. Mm. So Gates having that computer down the street, or that computer in eighth grade, gives him his 10,000 hours before anyone else who was that age. The Beatles, before they come to America, get invited to go to Hamburg. They're still teenagers, and they become a house band in a strip club, and they play 8-hour sets 7 days a week for months at a time. They get their 10,000 hours in before the British invasion, right? That's why they're good. I mean, it's not the only reason, but absent that kind of intensive grad school in rock and roll, they're not the band that we think they are, and they don't make that splash when they come to America.
And I assume that you could look at people who have been great athletes where there's a demand for performance at a young age and discover that they started practicing under very good circumstances very early. Tiger Woods would be exhibit one.
Would be exhibit one. And the key, what you just said is key, what you said under very good circumstances. This is not just Michael Jordan going out and shooting baskets. The term that expertise researchers use is deliberate practice. That is to say, focused, intensive practice with an eye to zeroing in on your failures and addressing them, your weaknesses. And I'm sure, I would love to have a camera on Michael Jordan as a 16-year-old as he plays basketball and seeing, because I am convinced that that's what sets him apart, that when he practiced in a different way. And that he was constantly thinking about what am I not doing well and why am I not doing it well and what can I do to perfect it.
Because, he didn't make his team as a 14-year-old or something.
Oh, yeah.
The junior
yeah.
high team didn't make it and then became a star and got a scholarship to University of North Carolina.
What's interesting, just to talk about Michael Jordan for a second, unlike a lot of other basketball players, his game changes dramatically over the course of his professional career. And he's not a great outside shooter when he starts and has a, devastating jump shot by the time he retires. So he never stopped this kind of constant process.
He added to his arsenal once he became a pro, even. There have been lots of examples of that. People that had a certain kind of college career, and then they found out once they got to be a pro that they needed to add to it. But what do we read into this? We read into this access to deliberate practice over 10,000 times.
Yes.
May give you the opportunity for success.
Yes.
The opportunity.
Yeah. Yes. And that's a big thing because, ultimately this book ends up with a series of kind of policy prescriptions because it's supposed to be a way of thinking about this question of how do we help people achieve their potential, right? And there's all kinds of ways to do that. And the very simple answer from the book is you give them opportunities to work harder. And so I end the book, for example, with a chapter about the KIPP academies in this new breed of charter school, which is really based on this idea. There's nothing fancy about what they do. What they do is extend the school day, extend the school year into the summer, have school start at 7 and go until 6 at night, and have them come in on Saturday. And for kids who want to work harder, they will give you that opportunity. And the insight is that kids who want to work hard can't work hard unless there's a school there to do it.
That's true, too. But, I mean, what separates the kids who want to work hard from those that don't?
I have one of the chapters in the book is about Jewish lawyers.
Yes, right? Exactly. It's wonderful.
And it's all about this group of men
right.
who rise from the Bronx in Brooklyn,
right.
Children of immigrants from Europe, grew up, parents in the garment industry, grew up in the tenements.
Right, in the 1930s.
In the 30s and 40s, and end up at the top of the legal profession in New York. This is hunger, right?
Right.
So, and one of the central ideas in that chapter is this notion that it was because they were discriminated against as Jews coming out of law school, and as a result, forbidden to work at the big downtown law firms, that they went out on their own and took up this unfashionable area of corporate law called takeovers and practiced it in isolation and obscurity for 20 years, and then
all of a sudden it became a big deal.
Big deal, and they were at the top of the game.
And they were prepared.
But
preparation
that,
meets opportunity.
That slight, though, at the beginning, the big fancy WASPy law firm telling these kids named, you know, Greenberg or Flom or what have you, that you can't work here.
And we don't care what your grades were at Harvard.
And we don't care what you, or in their case, NYU.
Yeah, right.
But, well, yeah, we don't care. That, you know, that slight is of incalculable importance. I mean, you just said that Jordan doesn't make his team
when
he's 14, right? Again, that slight is that, I think that is the kind of added psychological.
But do you have that gene in you?
Did I have it? I don't think I've ever had a slight, but I'm not.
Not a slight. I mean, I don't think it has to be born of a slight.
No.
I think it can come from, and that's the intriguing question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just saw Rolling Stone. I mean, yeah, Rolling Stone
has
got a list of the 25 greatest singers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And including John Lennon.
Yeah.
Now, talent had something to do with this.
Yes. Yeah.
So where do we put that?
You know, obviously it's there. What's fascinating to me is in the psychological literature on expertise, there are a whole group of psychologists for whom I have an infinite amount of respect who will stand up and with a straight face say that talent doesn't exist, that it's all application and effort. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if I'm willing to go that far, but what that tells me is, look, we think it's this much, and it's not. It's this much. You know, it's some tiny fraction of what we think it is.
I believe that because I'm being fascinated by the subject
mm-hmm.
of talent and performance and what makes people the way they are. I have, in the history of doing this, more than 30 years, this show, 18 years, I have never had somebody say to me, you know, the reason I'm so good at what I do is because I'm smarter than everybody else.
Yeah.
It is all because I wanted it more, I worked harder, I focused more, I sacrificed more, and, more importantly, I had a deep passion mm-hmm. for the thing.
Yeah.
Whether it was swinging a golf ball, hitting a basketball, doing scientific research, being a diplomat.
Yeah, yeah.
And they never lose it.
Yeah.
And it is their best friend, their very best friend. Everything else takes... You know, and then you get into work balance and all that stuff. Am I right?
Yeah. No, when I think about the story of the Beatles, what's fascinating about them, of course, is that they went to Hamburg in the 50s and were a house band for a strip club. Do we have any idea how miserable that must have been? 8-hour sets. You must really, truly love rock and roll if you're willing to play as a house band in a Hamburgian strip club.
Exactly,
I mean, it's like the nastiest situation.
Yeah. You're willing to take the sacrifices necessary to get there.
Yeah.
So what do we know about Barack Obama? I mean, here's a man who's had phenomenal success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's at the epitome of power in the world.
Yeah. Well, there's two parts of Barack Obama that fascinate me. You know, the second half of my book is all about culture,
right.
but the role that culture plays in success, and how different cultures have very, very different strengths in different. And so I spend a lot of time contrasting Asian and Western cultures, for example, and talking about how Asians kids are better at mathematics for cultural reasons, that there's something about their culture that's beautifully suited to
the
test.
This is intriguing, though. I mean, it tells what it has to do with.
Well, I think it has to do. So we make this observation that there's a huge difference in the performance of Asian kids and Western kids on math tests, right? And we know it's not. We've refuted the genetic argument. They're not genetically better at it. And we also know that from a series of psychological tests that they work harder, and that's the key. They're just simply willing to persevere more. The application of effort is greater. So why? And I have this whole chapter, which is, yes. I think it has to do with patterns of agricultural practice going back hundreds, if not thousands.
Having to do
years.
With rice.
Rice. My father's European peasant ancestors, who were, in the wheat fields of northern England, probably worked 1,000 hours a year and had lots of holidays and were drunk most of the winter and sleeping and worked till noon every day, right? Their Chinese counterparts in that same period were working 3,000 hours a year, weren't drinking out off the afternoons, and weren't sleeping through the winter. They were putting in a second crop of rice. Rice cultures are renowned for the fact that rice is infinitely more labor-intensive than traditional Western agriculture. And I think that if a culture engages in that kind of intensive work for 1,500 years, it doesn't go away. And so you take that child who is the product of that kind of culture.
It makes you good at math.
You sit that child down in front of a calculus problem, and they're going to approach it differently. And, some people laugh when I give this theory, but here's the thing. No one has a better theory, right? We don't have any other explanation.
I know.
And the difference between Asian and Western performance is not this much. It's this much. It's enormous, right?
I mean, that's always a very good question and a good argument. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. What's the better idea? Yeah. And nobody says,
Someone's got to give you a better idea.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. 2 years ago, my life changed forever. My wife, Kelsey, and I welcomed our daughter, Leela, into the world. Now, becoming a parent is an amazing, amazing experience. Your whole world changes overnight, and all of your priorities change immediately, so fast that it makes it really difficult to process sometimes. Now, you also have to learn a tremendous amount about being a parent. Like, for example, how to dress your child. This was new to me. This is an actual outfit. I thought this was a good idea. And even Leela knows that it's not a good idea. So there was so much to learn and so much craziness all at once. And to add to the craziness, Kelsey and I both work from home. We're entrepreneurs. We run our own businesses. So Kelsey is develops courses online for yoga teachers. I'm an author. And so I'm working for home. Kelsey's working for home. We have an infant. And we're trying to make sure that everything gets done that needs done. And life is really, really, really busy. And a couple weeks into this amazing experience, when the sleep deprivation really kicked in, like around week 8, I had this thought, and it was the same thought that parents across the ages, internationally, everybody has had this thought, which is, I am never going to have free time ever again. And somebody said it's true. Yeah, it's not exactly true, but it feels really, really true in that moment. And this was really disconcerting to me because one of the things that I enjoy more than anything else is learning new things, getting curious about something and diving in and fiddling around and learning through trial and error, and eventually becoming pretty good at something. And without this free time, I didn't know how I was ever going to do that ever again. And so I'm a big geek. I want to keep learning things. I want to keep growing. And so what I decided to do was go to the library and go to the bookstore and look at what research says about how we learn and how we learn quickly. And I read a bunch of books, I read a bunch of websites, and trying to answer this question, how long does it take to acquire a new skill? You know what I found? 10,000 hours. Anybody ever heard this? 10,000, it takes 10,000 hours. If you want to learn something new, if you want to be good at it, it's going to take 10,000 hours to get there. And I read this in book after book and website after website. And the my mental experience of reading all of this stuff was like, no, I don't have time. I don't have 10,000 hours. I am never going to be able to learn anything new ever again. But that's not true. So 10,000 hours, just to give you a rough order of magnitude, 10,000 hours is a full-time job for 5 years. That's a long time. And we've all had the experience of learning something new, and it didn't take us anywhere close to that amount of time, right? So what's up? There's something kind of funky going on here. What the research says and what we expect and have experiences, they don't match up. And what I found, here's the wrinkle. The 10,000-hour rule came out of studies of expert-level performance. There was a professor at Florida State University. His name is K. Anders Ericsson. He's the originator of the 10,000-hour rule. And where that came from is he studied professional athletes, world-class musicians, chess grandmasters, all of these ultra-competitive folks in ultra-high-performing fields, and he tried to figure out how long does it take to get to the top of those kinds of fields. And what he found is the more deliberate practice, the more time that those individuals spent practicing the elements of whatever it is that they do, the more time you spend, the better you get. And the folks at the tippy top of their fields put in around 10,000 hours of practice. Now, we're talking about the game of telephone a little bit earlier. Here's what happened. An author by the name of Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book in 2007 called Outliers, The Story of Success. And the centerpiece of that book was the 10,000-hour rule. Practice a lot, practice well, and you will do extremely well. You reach the top of your field. So the message, what Dr. Ericsson was actually saying is, it takes 10,000 hours to get to the top of an ultra-competitive field in a very narrow subject. That's what that means. But here's what happened. Ever since Outliers came out, immediately came out, reached the top of the bestseller list, stayed there for 3 solid months. All of a sudden, the 10,000-hour rule was everywhere. And a society-wide game of telephone started to be played. So this message, it takes 10,000 hours to reach the top of an ultra-competitive field, became, it takes 10,000 hours to become an expert at something. Which became, it takes 10,000 hours to become good at something. Which became, it takes 10,000 hours to learn something. But that last statement, it takes 10,000 hours to learn something, it's not true. It's not true. So, what the research actually says, if I spent a lot of time here at the CSU library in the cognitive psychology stacks, because I'm a geek. And when you actually look at the studies of skill acquisition, you see over and over and over a graph like this. Now, researchers, whether they're studying a motor skill, something you do physically, or a mental skill, they like to study things that they can time, because you can quantify that, right? So they'll give research participants a little task, something that requires physical arrangement or something that requires learning a little mental trick, and they'll time how long a participant takes to complete the skill. And here's what this graph says. When you start, so when researchers gave participants a task, it took them a really long time because it was new and they were horrible. With a little bit of practice, they get better and better and better, and that early part of practice is really, really efficient. People get good at things with just a little bit of practice. Now, what's interesting to note is that if, you know, we don't really, for skills that we want to learn for ourselves, we don't care so much about time, right? We just care about how good we are, whatever good happens to mean. So if we relabel performance time to how good you are, the graph flips, and you get this famous and widely known, this is the learning curve. And the story of the learning curve is when you start, you're grossly incompetent and you know it, right? With a little bit of practice, you get really good really quick. So that early level of improvement is really fast. And then at a certain point, you reach a plateau, and the subsequent gains become much harder to get. They take more time to get. Now, my question is, I want that, right? How long does it take from starting something and being grossly incompetent and knowing it to being reasonably good in, hopefully, as short a period of time as possible? So, how long does that take? Here's what my research says. 20 hours. That's it. You can go from knowing nothing about any skill that you can think of. Want to learn a language? Want to learn how to draw? Want to learn how to juggle flaming chainsaws? If you put 20 hours of focused, deliberate practice into that thing, you will be astounded, at how good you are. 20 hours is doable. That's about 45 minutes a day for about a month, even skipping a couple days here and there. 20 hours isn't that hard to accumulate. Now, there's a method to doing this, because it's not like you can just start fiddling around for about 20 hours and expect these massive improvements. There's a way to practice intelligently. There's a way to practice efficiently that will make sure that you invest those 20 hours in the most effective way that you possibly can. And here's the method. It applies to anything. The first is to deconstruct the skill. Decide exactly what you want to be able to do when you're done, and then look into the skill and break it down into smaller and smaller pieces. Most of the things that we think of as skills are actually big bundles of skills that require all sorts of different things. The more you can break apart the skill, the more you're able to decide what are the parts of the skill that will actually help me get to what I want, and then you can practice those first. And if you practice the most important things first, you'll be able to improve your performance in the least amount of time possible. The second is learn enough to self-correct. So get 3 to 5 resources about what it is you're trying to learn. Could be books, could be DVDs, could be courses, could be anything. But don't use those as a way to procrastinate on practice. I know I do this, right? Get like 20 books about the topic. It's like, I'm going to start learning how to program a computer when I complete these 20 books. No, that's procrastination. What you want to do is learn just enough that you can actually practice and self-correct or self-edit as you practice. So the learning becomes a way of getting better at noticing when you're making a mistake and then doing something a little different. The third is to remove barriers to practice. Distractions, television, internet, all of these things that get in the way of you actually sitting down and doing the work. And the more you're able to use just a little bit of willpower to remove the distractions that are keeping you from practicing, the more likely you are to actually sit down and practice, right? And the fourth is to practice for at least 20 hours. Now, most skills have what I call a frustration barrier. You know, the grossly incompetent knowing it part? That's really, really frustrating. We don't like to feel stupid. And feeling stupid is a barrier to us actually sitting down and doing the work. So by pre-committing to practicing whatever it is that you want to do for at least 20 hours, you will be able to overcome that initial frustration barrier and stick with the practice long enough to actually reap the rewards. All right, that's it. It's not rocket science. 4 very simple steps that you can use to learn anything. Now, this is easy to talk about in theory, but it's more fun to talk about in practice. So one of the things that I've wanted to learn how to do for a long time is play the ukulele. Has anybody seen Jake Shimabukuro's TED Talk where he plays the ukulele and makes it sound like he's like an ukulele god? It's amazing. It's like I saw that. It's like, that is so cool. It's such a neat instrument. I would really like to learn how to play. And so I decided that to test this theory, I wanted to put 20 hours into practicing the ukulele and see where we got. And so the first thing about playing the ukulele is, in order to practice, You have to have one, right? So I got an ukulele, and my lovely assistant. Thank you, sir. I think I need the cord here. It's not just an ukulele, it's an electric ukulele. Yeah. So the first couple hours are just like the first couple hours of anything. You have to get the tools that you're using to practice. You have to make sure that they're available. My ukulele didn't come with strings attached. I had to figure out how to put those on. Like, that's kind of important, right? And learning how to tune and learning how to make sure that all of the things that need to be done in order to start practicing get done, right? Now, one of the things when I was ready to actually start practicing was I looked in online databases and songbooks for how to play songs. And they say, okay, ukuleles, you can play more than one string at a time, so you can play chords. That's cool. You're accompanying yourself. Yay, you. And when I started looking at songs, I had an ukulele chord book that had like hundreds of chords. Like looking at the same, like, whoa, that's intimidating. But when you look at the actual songs, you see the same chords over and over, right? As it turns out, playing the ukulele is kind of like doing anything. There's a very small set of things that are really important and techniques that you'll use all the time. And so in most songs, you'll use 4, maybe 5 chords, and that's it. That's the song. You don't have to know the hundreds as long as you know the 4 or the 5. So while I was doing my research, I found a wonderful little medley of pop songs by a band called Axis of Awesome. And somebody knows it. And what Axis of Awesome says is that you can learn, or you can play pretty much any pop song of the past 5 decades if you know 4 chords. And those chords are G, D, E minor, C. 4 chords pump out every pop song ever, right? So I thought, this is cool. I would like to play every pop song ever. So that was the first song I decided to learn, and I would like to actually share it with you. Ready? All right. Just a small town girl living in a lonely world. She took a midnight train going anywhere. I heard that you settled down, that you found a girl, that you're married now. Every night in my dreams I see you, I feel you. That's just how I know we'll go on. I won't hesitate no more, no more. It cannot wait, I'm yours. Cause you are amazing. We did amazing things. If I could, then I would. I'd go wherever you will. And can you feel the love tonight? Cause it is with or without you. When I find myself, in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me. Sometimes I feel like I don't have a partner. No woman, no cry, I'm on the surely is a dream. I come from a London under. Once a jolly swag man camped by a billabong. Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy. Now here's my number, so call me. Hey, sexy lady, whoop, 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 I'm Gangnam Style. Time to say goodbye. Closing time. Every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end. Thank you. Thank you. I love that song. And I have a secret to share with you. So by playing that song for you, I just hit my 20th hour of practicing the ukulele. Thank you. And so it's amazing, pretty much anything that you can think of. What do you want to do? The major barrier to learning something new is not intellectual. It's not the process of you learning a bunch of little tips or tricks or things. The major barrier is emotional. We're scared. Feeling stupid doesn't feel good. In the beginning of learning anything new, you feel really stupid. So the major barrier is not intellectual, it's emotional. But put 20 hours into anything. Doesn't matter. What do you want to learn? Do you want to learn language? Do you want to learn how to cook? Do you want to learn how to draw? What turns you on? What lights you up? Go out and do that thing. It only takes 20 hours. Have fun.
Great job.
All right, that we listened to the two audios we listened to. The first one before this one was Malcolm Gladwell. He's written several books, but the book that he was speaking about, the 10,000 hour rule, coming out of the book that he wrote titled Outliers. And in the book Outliers, for those, just to summarize it, the meat of the book again is that anybody can become world class at anything. Let's start off with this. Let's say you know zip about a particular subject. You don't know how to do it. You don't have any visible talent on becoming whatever. In the book Outliers, Blackwell says essentially, and he gives examples, that if you put in 10,000 quality hours, you can become world class at anything. All right. Now, what is 10,000 hours equals about, if you put in eight quality hours a day, 40 quality hours a week, and in 5 years, you'll be a world class whatever you want to learn. A language, chef, athlete, what have you. Okay. Now, the last audio that I just played stated, and this is out of the book, the first 20 hours. Okay, because a lot of people get intimidated by 10,000 hours. Well, in the first 20 hours, and this is the first quality 20 hours out of the 10,000 hours, the first 20 hours says, okay, if you know nothing, okay, don't know how to do it, don't have any visible talent at whatever you want to learn. He says, in the first 20 hours, and everybody, no matter how good they are now on the planet, doing what they were doing, past or present or future, everybody has to conquer the first 20 quality hours. Everybody. One example is walking. Everybody who can stand up on their feet and run or walk didn't come out of the womb running and walking. Learn how to get enough strength so we can stand up. Everybody had to do that. That's part of the first quality 20 hours. Then after that, we had the confidence that, you know, we would take one step and fall down. Everybody, that's part of the learning curve. Everybody has to do that. And you keep on doing that, you bust your lip, hit your head and all this, and eventually you can walk. But then you got to learn how to run, and it's the same process over again. So whether you want to be an auto mechanic, athlete or whatever. So the first 20 hours. Now, the first 20 hours does not say you're going to be a master at something. It does not say you're going to be world-class at anything. The first 20 hours, you're essentially learning some of the fundamentals or the basic fundamentals to the point where you can self-correct, where you can self-correct. And there are different ways to do it. There are different ways to do it. So in today's podcast is titled Solving Problems by Making Widgets, and that's the making widgets part, because the widget could be you want to learn something, you need to master something, but there's something that you're going to need to do. I'll give you an example. And I've mentioned this before. My mother took out a reverse mortgage. She can't pay that thing back. All right. Somebody's got to pay it, because that's what a reverse mortgage is. A mortgage is a loan. Somebody is going to pay it back, which in my case, although I didn't take it out, she took it out, I'm going to have to do it. She borrowed $100,000. It's up to like $160,000 now that she owes, counting $500 a month, each month that is not paid. Now, she's bedridden. So obviously, because she made good money when she was working, but she's retired plus bedridden now. So obviously, you know, that's not going to happen. She's not going to be able to pay it back. Two, anybody, you're not going to be able to pay it back by a 9-to-5 job, typical 9-to-5 job. I'm not in the network marketing or multi-level marketing, so so I found the widget, and this is why I titled this podcast Solving Problems by Making Widgets. Because the widget that I'm selecting to get her debt-free in a matter of months, we're not talking about 30 months, we're not talking about 60 months, anything like, we're not even talking 36 months. We're talking about like 20 months or less. Actually, 18 months or less. All right. Is I essentially have to select a widget. Now, the widget that I'm selecting are tiny houses. I'm not a carpenter. I don't desire to be a carpenter or a master carpenter, anything like that. I want to learn enough. I'm in about hour 6. I want to learn enough in my first 20 hours. Now, mind you, I've done some work in help building structures, but my mindset's differently. Now I'm looking at how does this whole thing break down? Because essentially, to extinguish her debt, I've got to essentially build and sell about 160 tiny houses, all right? So what I'm doing now is essentially, what are the component parts? I had to deconstruct on a broad base what are the fundamental parts of this particular widget, which for the sake of this conversation, we call a tiny house. And that's foundations, framing, foundations, floor framing, wall framing, and roofing. Those are the four basic component parts of a house, be it tiny or anything else. Now, the other subcategories included, but we're talking about the fundamentals of this particular project that I'm working on. Now, if you go to, if you're online, go to Facebook, and I'm sharing part of my first 6 hours with you. Yesterday we had the materials delivered for the foundation and the floor framing. So if you go to Facebook Earth Wealth Energy Village, that's one of our Facebook pages. You'll see what I had delivered yesterday. I had the foundation that I'm choosing will be a deck deck blocks. And we'll explain the reason why I'm doing that on another podcast. Deck blocks. I got here's the other. There are two Facebook pages. Jake Rector Energy Academy. That's, and I'll spell Jake Rector. Jake Rector is one word. J A K E. Rector, R-E-C-T-O-R, is one word. Jake Rector, Energy Facademy, F-A-C-A-D-E-M-Y, Facademy. That stands for Factory School. One of the reasons why I call it a Facademy, because I believe that the academic system of education to a high degree is bullshit. But that's another podcast. Anyway, so instead of calling it an academy, we call it a Facademy. It's a factory school. People that go to this school learn how to make things that they can sell to solve any kind of personal finance problem that they might have. That's Jake Rector Energy Academy. And we'll get into the we never have a separate podcast on that. Now, on that Facebook page, Jake Rector Energy Academy, F-A-C-A-D-E-M-Y, Academy. Jake Rector Energy Academy. You'll have pictures on there of the delivery I took yesterday, which has a picture of the deck blocks, 2x4s, 2x6x10s, that stuff that came in yesterday. All right. And that's for, because we had to, I'm in my sixth hour, yesterday at least, 6 hours of my first 20 hours. I know I'm not going to be a master. I won't even be able to call myself a carpenter, but that's okay. My goal is to learn enough so I can teach somebody else on how to do, look, this is the way I want it done. Because I'm not going to be, you have to know when to hire an expertise, and then you have to know when to hire somebody or deal with somebody that doesn't have a certain level of expertise, and they're a blank slate. I want the blank slates, so I'm learning enough to teach the blank slates here with no fucking arguments. This is the way I want this foundation done. This is the time limit in which we want it done in. So I've got to be able to physically teach them how to do that. And then for the intricate details, I'll bring in a carpenter, you know, but whatever. So on those two Facebook pages, we just have, you know, we have video and pictures of what we took in yesterday. Even a video, because I got to hire a videographer. We're to the stage now where because when we take these podcasts live with a live stream, we got to have somebody that actually can do a video, because I can't hold the camera, demonstrate, I can't do it. So we're to the point now where we've got to actually have other people produce the podcast, you know, do the camera work for the live streams and all that. But so Earth Wealth Energy Village on Facebook and Jake Rector Energy Academy on Facebook, those two pages, you'll see pictures of what came in yesterday. And then tomorrow, we'll probably have something else on there where I lay out, you know, I lay out the block decks. The house that I've selected, and now I'm in Florida doing this. So, because I'm trying to get, that's another project. But when we get out to Oklahoma before the end of this year, in Oklahoma, what we'll be doing is we'll be seeing it done in real time, from step by step, deck block, floor framing, wall framing, roof framing, you know, get everything inside and out completed. And because when I get there, we got about 10 days, actually 5 days, to put up 3 to 5 buildings. I decided already for security purposes. Matter of fact, on the Facebook page of Earth Wealth Energy Academy, the very top picture is an aerial view of Earth Wealth Energy Village. That's about 1.8 acres of land. That's the top view of it on that page. We've got ground views of it. All right, it's got maybe one tree on it, but it's clear. So instead of putting one building on there, for security reasons, we're going to put 3 to 5 buildings on there. And I got to do this on a budget, people. I'm not borrowing any money. I'm not going to a bank. I'm not taking on any partners. Mainly because I don't want no shit. And no trollism. So, anyway, so that's what we got there. So we'll have by Thursday or Friday, tomorrow Friday, we'll have new video of the fundamentals. Now, I'm saying all that to say, getting back to the first 20 hours, and that goes to, I believe, when I open up my mic, that anybody, if they, number one, have the desire, that's number one. You can be a straight-up scrub. You can be an F student. As a matter of fact, one of the books that formulated my belief system that anybody can do anything or learn anything and become good at anything if they have their self-image intact first. My high school, one of my high school basketball coaches, Morgan Wooten, in ninth grade, he told us about a book. It's a classic self-help book. I read the book. I've read that book twice to the covers were off of it. It's titled Psycho-Cybernetics by Dr. Maxwell Maltz, M-A-L-T-Z, Psycho-Cybernetics. And Maxwell Maltz was a plastic surgeon. And in the book, the meat of the book is this. He says your self-image, how you see yourself, is the number one factor in what you can achieve in life. Because he was a plastic surgeon, and some people got a new face, and they thought a new face would be their key to success and happiness. But in many cases, it wasn't. So in the book, he goes into how a person can basically develop their self-image and achieve the results that they want. Now, so I believe if going from that book's Psycho-Cybernetics by Matthew Maltz, you got to have a healthy, intact self-image. Within that, you have the desire. And with that, step two, place yourself. I'm a big believer. You know, we've heard the discussion of environment versus heredity. I believe environment contributes to 80-90% for the kind of results you want in life. But I believe environment weighs more. That's why I don't buy into white supremacy. You can't tell me a white person smarter than me. Inherently, from the giddy up, and smart, no, I refuse to believe it. You can't tell me, well, put it right, that is a better word. You can't tell me a white person is more supreme than me. Some might be better at calculus than, but I might be better than them, whoever it is on an individual basis, and 10 or 20 other things. People are people. People are people. I believe environment plays your mental environment. Matter of fact, if you look at the and we might have to do a podcast on this maybe tomorrow. on the presidency of Barack Obama, particularly the first time he got elected. Prior to him getting elected, on a critical mass basis, African Americans, on a critical mass basis, now this is just my opinion, keep listening, because not all black people are like him, not all people like, believe that, including me, there is there's no way a black person is going to get elected president of the United States, not in our lifetime. And it happened. And I'm looking at the reason why it happened, I believe 95% of it or better, it was Barack Obama's belief system and an environment. He grew up in an environment where the thought of you can't achieve something, particularly president of the United States, it didn't affect him. Anyway, self-image, self-belief, number one, you got to have that desire. Number two, fundamentals. If you learn the fundamentals of something, And pulling the quality hours, okay, I'm not saying that any of those 20 quality hours you're going to be world-class, you're not. Whether you're good, mediocre, whatever, doesn't matter. But you'll know enough to self-correct and keep on practicing and applying the fundamentals. We're not concerned with the 10,000 hours. Okay. I mean, if you want to learn how to boil an egg and you're not interested in becoming a world-class egg boiler, you don't need to put in 10,000 hours and read books and go to college and learn how to boil an egg. You know, put in a pot and you'll probably get that one down in a few minutes. What I'm saying is anybody can learn anything. And going back to our title today, if you put in the work required, the first 20 hours to learn a particular skill set for a particular widget that you might be in, that can help your situation out financially or whatever social problem, if you put in those 20 quality hours, like some people, you know what, social services office. Most of the people at the social services office, and I'm not knocking going to the social services office, but most of the people at the social services office are basically, use the social services office, are socially bankrupt. They have burnt bridges, not all of them, but a lot of them to a critical mass basis. They have burnt bridges where they can't go to friends or relatives to sleep on a couch, borrow $5 to get a Big Mac, get some diaper or pampers for their kids or whatever. They're socially bankrupt for the most part. I believe if you take a person out of that social services office, which is relying on the government, and they're open, they're mentally and psychologically open to, look, I'm going to give you 20 hours of how to be a nice person, and how to build social capital and build and maintain relationships. Because what's happening in our modern world, particularly in Western countries, we shit on people. People are disposable. Everything's disposable. Either it's instant, you know, instant coffee, instant oatmeal, instant this, instant that. You know, I get mad at you in a relationship. You know what? The relationship is over. I'm going on Facebook. I'll find somebody new. And today you can do that. But then you're carrying that same old baggage with you into the new relationship. And then it keeps on repeating, What I'm saying is essentially in environment, if take the person out of the social service office, teach them on how to be a nice person, teach them the value of relationships, the value of people, and how to build social capital, that person will never, ever have to go to the social services office and depend on the government again. Actually, to tell, let me give you a good example. And some people might think I'm stock raving crazy when I give this example. I'll go to the phones. First in the social services office and Donald Trump. I'm saying that Donald Trump has better social skills than a typical person in the social services office. And I know some of you right now think I'm totally mad. I've lost it. Here's how I'm going to prove my point. All right. Once again, the person in the social services office, people go to social services as a last resort. They go to the social services office, they go to the government as a last resort because they don't have enough social capital. They don't have any friends or relatives that maybe can buy them a bottle of Tylenol if they're sick, or NyQuil if they're sick, or buy them a few knick-knack groceries if they don't have anything to eat. Or, you know what, you can sleep on my couch or my spare bedroom or garage until you get back on your feet. They burn bridges socially with their blood relatives. They burn bridges with their friends. The only entity that they can go to is the government through the social services office. That people, once again, people that typically go to the social services office and use these entitlement programs are typically socially bankrupt in some way, shape, form, or manner. Now, let's go to Donald Trump. Donald Trump, although he said, you can call him a racist, he might be one. He said some insensitive things. But now here's the difference between Donald Trump or the typical billionaire and a person in the social services office. A billionaire can say, he can go among his friends and say, look, we're going to have a $20,000 plate dinner for this particular cause. Go in their Rolodex or email account or whatever, or Facebook account or whatever. And they've got enough social capital where they can get a room of 100, 200, 500 people that'll pay $20,000 a plate on their social relationship with Donald Trump. Who's the bigger asshole? The person in the social services office on a critical mass basis, or Donald Trump. Social capital is real social security. In any event, it'll be helpful to have that in your first 20 hours, too. Because that's what I did. I sought out master carpenters on, you know, different levels, woodworkers on different levels until, you know, I found a couple people that, and I'm nice to these people, sincerely nice, and they've given me, I would say, I can't even put a dollar value on the information that they've given me. Let's see, let's go to the phone lines here. 314, your mic is open. We're going off topic.
Hey, you've been having class for a long time, man. That's really good. You should be a professor in a university.
I had to make my own university.
Yeah, but that one piece you played about the 10,000 hours, you know, when I started training my grandson to become a baseball player, I used to hit him 100 ground balls. And if he got the 87 and booped it, he had to start all over. Now, that did make him a whole lot better, but it also just put a toll on me, too, which I don't like to talk about, but it did. And the same thing with doing personal achievement. the brother, the Nigerian, Emeka Wale, have you heard of him?
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who came up with the idea. Yeah, he came up with the idea. Philip Emeka Wale. He came up with the idea of parallel computers in order to achieve the speeds that we see today. His father used to make him do 100 math problems a day, starting off very young. And until he got to a level where he could do math problems that his father could no longer do. So, yes, those type of repetition until you get it perfect is very valuable. And if you ever do the research and question people who do outstanding things, unusual, comparatively to the rest of the field, you will see that they had a lot of development along the sorts that we are mentioning. And it does pay off.
Right. There's a movie on, I think it's still on Netflix. It's called, I think it's called The Queen of Cat Lane. True story. Disney produced it about a young lady in Uganda. And he taught her how to play chess. And she was in the slums of Uganda. And he taught her, like you said, he taught her how to play chess. And she got to the point because she was practicing and reading about chess by candlelight. She went above and above what he was teaching her to a point where he couldn't teach me her anymore. But he had the connections to get her. She became a world-class chess player and turned that into good things for the family. But I think it's Queen of Catway. It's on, Netflix or Amazon, or probably YouTube. You rented or bought it. And, excellent movie on, just if you don't know something, get learn the fundamentals. And then put in the quality time behind it.
Mm-hmm. When our families used to go out to the parks for to get out, and cook and so on. I remember we should go to Carlisle Park there, and Carlisle Lake there in Illinois. I'd sit under a tree with a set of drawings, structural drawings, studying. Those drawings, whether they were state highway projects or whether they were private commercial projects, I would use them and study and practice before I started my business. And of course, which became my competitor and also a good friend. But that's the way you do those things. You have to put in the time in order to reap the rewards. And another thing I teach young is to do jobs that others don't want to do. Because just by doing that, you create a impressive view on yourself by others. Look, he's doing something that I didn't want to do, and he done it well. So I just wanted to add that.
Now, what you just said, I agree with you 1,000,000%, because that's where we can get into an immigration discussion on that one, because that's what they're doing. They're coming in here, or they're coming to the United States, learn the system legally. And I just like seeing Washington, D.C., Southeast D.C., a lot of those construction jobs, a lot of blacks turned their noses up at decades ago. Now they're complaining like we can't, they won't let us in. But when you have the opportunity to get in and learn, you didn't take advantage of that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you on what you say about Donald Trump, because simple, when I first heard him talking and the way he use acronyms, and the way he make rephrase the things and comment, I knew exactly what he was talking about. I felt comfortable in understanding what he was talking about. When they first ridiculed the locker room conversation that he had of grabbing women by their pussy, I knew exactly what he was talking about, because guess what? In my coming up amongst the other males, heck, we had conversations like that too, jokingly, or people would talk about their experiences. At least we were talking about grabbing them by the vagina and not by the penis. So,
right.
His social skills are very well.
Women have girl talk, men have locker room talk. It comes down to, well, you know, relating to people socially on a level where they understand. So,
You remember the Godfather? And the woman was talking to another woman, was making reference to the size of one of the guys and how she communicated to him. That was girl talk. And girls have talks like that, males also too. All right, thank you very much.
Oh yeah, girls. Oh man, I know that I was. This was years ago. I went out to a dinner with a friend of mine and a bunch of her girlfriends. I was the only male there, and I guess they forgot I was there. These women were going. They were worse than sailors. I mean, I heard some real girl talk. So, you're absolutely right. Anyway, on that note, that's it for today. Everyone have a good rest of the day.
At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking care of business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.